Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Today I'm interviewing Lester Brown, described as one of the world's most influential thinkers by the Washington Post. He is founder and president of Earth Policy Institute, a non-profit environmental research organization based in Washington, D.C. During a career that started with tomato farming, or as you say, tomato farming, Brown has been awarded 24 honorary degrees and has authored or co-authored over 50 books. One of the world's most widely published authors, his books have appeared in some 40 languages. His most recent book is entitled Plan B 3.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. Plan B 3.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. Welcome, Lester Brown.
Ellen, it's my pleasure.
Tell us who the publisher is of Plan B.
Our publisher in the States is W.W. Norton.
Oh.
But the book is also available online at our website. You can read it free of charge. You can download it if you want at earthpolicy.org.
That's wonderful. And yes, my books are published too by Norton, so we're brothers in arms.
They're a great publisher.
Aren't they wonderful? Absolutely. Now, the reason I specifically came to you, I did read your book because I've just been revising my book, If You Love This Planet, and as I revised it, I thought, why am I writing this book? Because Lester's already written all of this material. But I read the article that you published, Lester, in Scientific American, called Could Food Shortages Bring Down Civilization? The biggest threat to global stability is a potential for food crises in poor countries to cause government collapse. Now, I know we talk a lot about global warming and deforestation and all sorts of things, but this catastrophe is on the cutting edge, isn't it, of failed countries and what happens to failed countries. Would you like to define, Lester, what a failed country is?
Well, the term failed state has just entered our working vocabulary within the last decade or so. But a failed state is one where governments can no longer provide personal security. They often lose control of part of their territory. Pakistan at the moment is an example of that. And eventually, as governments weaken and become less able to satisfy the needs of society, whether it's personal security or food or education or healthcare or what have you, they begin to lose their legitimacy, and then a vacuum develops, and then tribal leaders or warlords or drug lords or whatever begin to take over. And there is now a very substantial list of failed and failing states, and they include countries like Somalia, Haiti, Democratic Republic of the Congo, more recently Zimbabwe, Iraq, Afghanistan. Pakistan, incidentally, is the first nuclear power to move into this category. A number of countries in Africa are in the failing state category. So this is a growing concern. And if I were to pick one political indicator that will tell us more about our future than any other, it would be the number of failing states in the world. Because as that list grows longer, it poses a difficult problem, a difficult question, which is, how many failing states before we have a failing global civilization? We don't know the answer to that question because we haven't been there before, but it's one of the things that I think we need to be focusing on.
So in the past, Lester Brown, what have been the number of failed states? Is there any historical reference to this present situation?
I suppose the closest thing we have to it is the records of the earlier civilizations that failed, like the Sumerians or the Mayans, and there are many others, and we study their archaeological sites today.
Mm.
But what we're seeing now, I don't think has any modern counterpart. I mean, at least during my lifetime, in the period since World War II, we've seen the creation of a huge number of states, initially from decolonization the creation of scores of new states. So we were concerned during that period about state building. But then we had the breakup of the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia, for example. So the number of states in the world has increased rather dramatically over the last several decades. But now some of those some of the states are beginning to, particularly those that have had sustained rapid rates of population growth, are beginning to break down under the stress. And the stress includes everything from food shortages to inability to build enough schools to get kids in school, inability to provide security, et cetera.
Well, I suppose if we looked at Zimbabwe, which was formerly, what was it? Zimbabwe?
Northern Rhodesia.
Yeah, Rhodesia. And what's happened under Mugabe, I suppose you could see a pattern there too, as the colonial powers pulled out, some then new leaders of the new states were able to sustain the economy and their countries. But for instance, people like Mugabe have just brought the country down to its knees. That must add to the problem.
Well, what's so interesting about Zimbabwe is that, you know, a decade or so ago, it was a model of how an ex-colonial country should work. And Mugabe himself pointed out that I think it was in Mozambique when they got their independence that they immediately ousted all the Europeans. And that happened, I think, in one or two other countries in Africa. And he was advised not to drive out the European farmers in Zimbabwe because they were such an important part of the economy and to build on what they were doing and to build around them. And he did that for a while. And there was a time when Zimbabwe was a model of development. And a similar thing happened in West Africa, where the Ivory Coast at one time was viewed as a model of development. And now both of them are high on the list of failing states.
Yes. And then there's Haiti, of course. That's in a terrible mess, isn't it, just to the south of the U.S.?
It is. It's a country that where, you know, the deforestation came first and then the soil erosion and then falling food production. And Haiti must import at least 40% of its grain today. And it's really kept alive by the World Food Program food support system. I mean, Haiti, without this lifeline from the World Food Program, would probably go up in flames.
Oh, dear. And who deforested Haiti? Was that foreign logging corporations, or was it done domestically?
I think in this case it was a matter of population growing and the need for more and more land to produce food, and they just kept clearing land until today. I think only 2% of the country is forested, and every time there's a storm, a hurricane that passes near Haiti, it's a catastrophe because there's just nothing to hold the water once it falls, and it just starts flowing and accumulating and doing enormous damage. I mean, it is interesting to to look at Haiti, which shares the island with the Dominican Republic, and from the air, you can see the territorial dividing line between the two, because the Dominican Republic is still, I don't know the exact percentage of forestation, but it's, you know, 20 or 30% or more. So most of the steeply sloping areas are forested, and the Dominican Republic is a reasonably stable country and doing all right economically, but Haiti has become an ecological basket case and therefore an economic basket case as well.
It's kind of like the Easter Islands, isn't it, where they chopped down all their trees?
Right, but even worse in some ways because of the climate and the terrain and the soils and so forth. And Haiti is, in addition to the World Food Program lifeline, there's a UN security force there that keeps armed gangs from taking over the country.
Because they got rid of Jean-Baptiste. What about, then we could go further south down to Brazil and Peru and other countries, Venezuela, and look at the Amazon, which is fast disappearing as well. That Lester Brown, will be a global catastrophe, will it not?
It will. And it's interesting that there have been, over the last century and a quarter or so, three sort of major land expansion efforts in the world. One came in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century, and it culminated in the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. I mean, that's become a chapter in our history now. And it took a very strong, well-organized response to stabilize that
situation.
Was that
because of deforestation across the U.S.?
And not so much deforestation, but overplowing of the grasslands in the Great Plains. And some of that land should never have been plowed, should have stayed in grass. So as a result of the Dust Bowl during the Roosevelt years, and this was also the time of the Great Depression, there was a huge effort to take some of that marginal land out of production, put it back into grass, to plant trees, shelter belts, change cropping patterns to alternate year cropping and strip cropping, and just a whole series of soil conservation measures were taken that did stabilize that situation.
Yeah.
But then in the late 1950s, the Russians, wanting very much to try and overtake the U.S. in agriculture, decided they were going to plow up a lot of land as well, most of it in what's now Kazakhstan. And in the late 50s, early 60s, they plowed an area of grass equal to the wheatland of Australia and Canada combined.
Good Lord.
I mean, it was a huge effort. And the agronomists were saying, you know, don't do it. But the planners in Moscow, the political types, were saying, we're going to overtake the U.S. and this is how we're going to do it. And by the mid-60s, they had a huge Dust Bowl, too. And 40% of that land that they plowed has now gone back to grass. So what we have in Brazil is the third great expansion of the last century or so. And I have a feeling that it may end up in the same way. What we're seeing is both the clearing of the Cerrado, which is sort of a savanna-like region south of the Amazon, and plowing that, and at the same time clearing the Amazon for agriculture. Usually begins by burning off the trees and grazing cattle, and then plowing the land and planting soybeans or other crops. But the inevitable result here is probably going to be, if the deforestation of the Amazon continues, is that at some point the rainforest will begin to dry out and will become vulnerable to natural fire with thunderstorms and lightning strikes and so forth. And when it reaches that point, it may have reached one of those key tipping points where there is no return. And so we could end up with the Amazon being at best a savanna sort of landscape and at worst a desert. And exactly how it's going to unfold is not yet clear, but There is growing some concern among ecologists that we're approaching a tipping point in the Amazon basin. If we don't get the brakes on soon, it may become an irreversible process.
And that will also change the climate in North America, right? Will it have an influence upon the climate in the U.S., for instance?
It will alter the climate system for the world because Brazil is a big country. The Amazon is a vast area. And one of the things that happens early on is that as you deforest in the coastal regions, you reduce the capacity of the rainforest to transmit water inland. The air masses move from the Atlantic Ocean across the Amazon, including the Amazon basin, until they hit the Andes, and then they begin to flow south. And those air masses historically carry moisture from the oceans inland and all the way down to eventually to southern Brazil and northern Argentina. But if you begin clearing land, then when it rains, 80% of the rainfall runs off and only 20% evaporates and is recycled inland. Whereas in a healthy stand of rainforest, when it rains, only 20% runs off and 80% evaporates and is carried further inland. So this mechanism is weakened by deforestation, and the risk is that southern Brazil and northern Argentina, Paraguay, that area, could begin to suffer from drought. And indeed, there are signs that process has already begun.
I've been to the Amazon and gone down the Orinoco River from Venezuela into the Amazon River itself. And as I did, every afternoon, huge cumulus clouds accumulate and there's a massive rainstorm every afternoon. They say that one tree transpires hundreds of gallons of water per day from its leaves into the air. Is that correct, Lester Brown?
I don't know the numbers exactly, but the reason tropical forests are called rainforests is because they do recycle water so efficiently. And if the air masses are moving inland, then that carries the water inland. And as you know, it's very difficult to burn a healthy rainforest. Mm. You have to wait till near the end of the dry season, and you have to cut some brush and dry it out and really work to get a fire going. But as the rainforest dries out, as more and more plots of land are cleared, then it becomes vulnerable to fire, and that's the critical tipping point we have to watch out.
Well, I know that much of the Amazon is being chopped down to grow beef for hamburgers for the U.S. market, and I think in your Scientific American article, Lester Brown, it takes... how many 4 pounds of grain a day to make 1 pound of meat? Is that accurate or is it not?
Once cattle are in the feedlot, incidentally, not many Brazilian cattle make it into the feedlot. They spend most of their life grazing and then go directly to market off the range. In the U.S., by contrast, the calves, the steers, are born on the range, and they spend 6 or 8 months there until they reach about 600 pounds. Then they go to a feedlot, and they're finished off until they weigh about 1,100 pounds and go to market. So we have the highly marbled beef with rather high fat content. But in the feedlot, it takes about 7 pounds of grain for each pound of live weight added. In the case of Brazil, it's almost all grass, and that's why they have to keep clearing more and more land as the world demand for beef grows. I don't think we actually import that much beef from Brazil, partly because if you're accustomed to eating grain-fed beef, then grass-fed beef is sort of lean and lacks the Some people would say it lacks the flavor of beef that's been in the
Well, we have grass-fed beef in Australia and sheep and lambs, and we think it's quite tasty. The other thing is that, of course, huge soybean crops are now being grown on cleared Amazon land. And, you know, we all think soybeans or the health-conscious people are good for us and they've got estrogenic properties and it's lower on the food chain. But in fact, much of the Amazon is being cleared now to grow soybeans, not just for human consumption, but also, I believe, animal consumption, particularly in Europe.
Now, particularly in China. It's sort of ironic that of the world's soybean crop, less than 10% would be consumed as food. The great bulk of the world's soybean crop is crushed and the oil is removed. That's about 20% of the total. The remaining 80%, the meal, is a high-protein meal, and it is used everywhere in the world today as a supplement in feed rations for pigs, for chickens, for cows, on fish farms in China. And China, which gave the world the soybean, is now far and away the largest importer. This year, China will import probably 37 million tons of soybeans. The second-ranking world soybean importer is Japan with 4 million tons. So you can see how totally dominant, China dominates the world soybean market. And so the two big suppliers are the United States and Brazil. And indeed, in the United States, we now have more land in soybeans than we have in wheat. And that's partly because of the huge demand in China.
Soybeans, yeah, it seems, I mean, when I was a child, we had three cats. And unfortunately, they were outside cats and they used to catch birds and possums and things. But we used to feed them on offal from the butcher, lungs, hearts, liver and the like. And they were very healthy. But now the industry to feed animals this sort of synthetic, if you will, food that's manufactured in huge factories, is that adding, in fact, to the global lack of food for human beings?
By that you mean feeding pets?
Yeah, feeding pets and also cows to eat and sheep and, you know, pigs and all of that. So both pets and meat to eat.
Right. Well, the meat to eat, and not just meat, but all livestock and poultry products. So that's beef and pork and poultry, milk, eggs, and all the things we make from milk, like cheese and yogurt and ice cream and all those things. About 35% of the world grain harvest is now fed to cows and pigs, chickens, and fish. Fish farming is really becoming huge, especially in China. Fish farming could overtake world beef production within the next few years. I mean, it most people don't realize how huge it's become. But once you put fish in ponds, you have to feed them. And what they're usually fed is a ration very similar to that fed to chickens, that is mostly corn and supplemented with soybean meal. So it takes a lot of soybean meal to feed all the pigs and chickens and cattle and now fish in countries like China and the U.S. and Europe and Japan.
So how many millions more people could be fed if that soybean was fed to people and not animals and fish?
Well, yeah, it's not quite as simple as it seems, partly because soybean yields are not very high. Soybeans are legumes, and the soybean plant invests heavily in producing protein, but it's not all that efficient compared with the corn plant, for example. And if in the state of Iowa you had an acre of land, you could plant that land in soybeans and consume the soybeans directly. You also could plant that acre in corn. And because the corn yield is three times as high as that of soybeans, you could feed that corn to chickens, and they require about 2 pounds of grain per pound of live weight. So in a sense, it would be more efficient in the use of land and water resources to consume poultry than to consume soybeans directly, because you can't get very high yields with soybeans. They are a legume, and they don't have the same efficiency as corn in converting sunlight into plant starches.
Well, why is the world so hooked now on soybean production if it's far less efficient at feeding both animals and humans?
Well, because not much of the world's soybean harvest is consumed directly as food.
Yeah.
As I mentioned earlier, it would be less than 10%. But what happens when you incorporate, say, 20% soybean meal with 80% grain and feed rations is that, one, you need less grain because you have some soybeans in the mix. But most importantly, having that soybean meal in the feed mix increases the efficiency with which livestock and poultry convert grain into meat or milk or eggs rather dramatically. And that's where soybeans are playing an important role in the world food economy. It is in increasing the efficiency with which grain is converted into meat,
How
milk,
fascinating.
And eggs.
That's because it's full of protein and legumes and nitrogen fixes from the soil and converted to protein. I'm interviewing Lester Brown, who's the founder and president of the Earth Policy Institute. Well, talk about feeding animals and fish and the like with corn and soybeans. Let's talk about feeding cars, Lester Brown.
Well, one of the things that has happened in the last several years now is that as the price of gasoline has gone up in the U.S., which it did right after Katrina, which was beginning of September in 2005, as I recall, the price of gasoline, which would have been maybe $1.20 or 30 or 40 cents a gallon, suddenly jumped up to $3 a gallon. And at that time, the price of corn was $2 a bushel. And since you could get 2.5 gallons of ethanol to put in cars from a bushel of corn, it suddenly became highly profitable to convert corn into fuel for cars. And what has happened is that we used to have a food economy and an energy economy, and they were pretty much separate. But now, with the enormous investment in ethanol distilleries in the United States, we're converting, now getting up close to a quarter of the U.S. grain harvest into fuel for cars. In tonnage terms, from this year's crop, it'll probably be close to 100 million tons of grain. That would be probably four times the grain harvest of Australia, something of that order of magnitude.
Good Lord.
I mean, it is huge. And what it means is that given this capacity to convert grain into fuel for cars, that the price of grain is now tied to the price of oil. And when the price of oil goes up, as it did beginning 2 or 3 years ago, eventually going over $140 a barrel, it pulled the price of grain up behind it. And then we had, beginning almost a year ago, the price of oil then starting to decline and dropping down under $40 a barrel. And so the pressure on grain supplies lightened a bit. In fact, some of the ethanol distilleries went bankrupt because they couldn't get a high enough price for their ethanol to stay in business. But what this means is that the price of food, the price of grain, is now tied to the price of oil. And if the food value of the price of grain is below the fuel value, the market will move the grain into the energy sector. And so we have set up a competition between the 860 million people in the world who own cars and who want to maintain their mobility, and most of them don't much care where the fuel comes from, whether it comes from an oil field or a cornfield. But for the low-income people in the world, this is bad news, because we've set up this competition between cars and people for the grain supply. And the interesting thing is that the average income of the 860 million people who own cars is something like $30,000 a year. The average income of the 2 billion poorest people in the world is more like $300 a year. There's a real inequity in the competition here, because it's easy to see who's going to win in this competition. And this is why the number of hungry people in the world has been increasing in recent years. Back in 1999 or so, when they were setting the Millennial Development Goals, the goal for agriculture was to reduce the number of hungry people in the world from just over 800 million people to 400 million people by 2015. Now, that was a laudable goal. But what happened was that after 2000, shortly after 2000, the price of grain started edging up. And then the last few years, we had this dramatic rise in price of grain. Price of wheat, rice, corn, and soybeans are roughly tripling between the beginning of 2007 and mid-2008. So the number of hungry people is estimated at the end of this year to be 960 million. So instead of going down, it's going up, and it's projected by USDA to keep increasing until it reaches 1.2 billion by, I think it's 2017. This is the 10-year projections made based on 2007 data. So this is another disturbing indicator. This is a social indicator, the increase in hunger. The indicator we talked about earlier that I'm very much concerned with is the growing number of failing states in the world. Now we have an increasing a number of hungry people in the world that has been increasing quite a bit in the last few years, and is projected to increase as far as we can comfortably see into the future. And this, I think, is a warning sign, because the risk is that with food prices on the rise, we could see more and more failing states, as governments are no longer able to provide food security for their people. The thing that's new, Helen, about the situation we're in now in terms of food prices, and incidentally, they've subsided over the past year, and instead of being triple historical levels, wheat and corn and rice and soybean prices are now roughly double historical levels. But they appear to be heading back up again. But the thing that's so interesting is that we have had, during the last half of the last century, for example, price surges from time to time. But they were always event-driven. It was a poor harvest in the Soviet Union, or a monsoon failure in India, or an intense heat wave and drought in the U.S. Corn Belt. But this rise in prices is not event-driven. Those former ones were event-driven, and by the next harvest, things would usually be back to normal. This current rise is trend-driven on the demand side of the equation. We're adding 79 million people a year. There are 3 or 4 billion people who want to move up the food chain. And then we have this inane competition between automobiles and people for the food supply. The IMF and the World Bank, they think that at least half of the rise in food prices over the last few years has been because of the diversion of so much grain, so much of the U.S. harvest to produce fuel for cars. cars. At the same time, on the supply side, we have new trends emerging that make it more difficult to expand production. One is soil erosion. That goes back to the beginning of agriculture itself. That's not new, but it's becoming more pronounced now and is affecting more of the world's cropland than ever before. The second thing is falling water tables. Water tables are now falling in countries that contain half the world's people. And in some countries where the water supplies are running out, like Saudi Arabia, they're basically phasing out irrigated agriculture and therefore agriculture altogether. They've been self-sufficient in wheat for the last 20-some years, but they've been able to produce this wheat by tapping an aquifer that's a half mile down. They use oil drilling technology to do that. But that aquifer is essentially a fossil aquifer, which means it doesn't recharge. And as a result, they have publicly announced that that aquifer is largely depleted, that they're phasing out irrigated wheat production, and by 2016, will be importing virtually all their grain. Then we have countries like India and China, where water tables are falling very fast. And it's estimated that about 175 million people in India are now being fed with grain produced by overpumping, and about 130 million people in China in the same category. When the wells go dry, as they're beginning to do, and as they've already done substantially in Saudi Arabia, but when they do it in some of these larger countries, the entire world will know it.
Oh, well, I want to go back to the feeding cars, not people again, to the grain and much of the grain in Iowa, that wonderfully rich agricultural state, is now going to produce ethanol for cars. But I thought the original drive to do this was that ethanol produces less CO2 when it's burnt than does oil. I thought that was the original drive and not being tied to the price of oil per se.
The ethanol fuel program in the U.S. was actually launched in 1978. And that was on the heels of the Arab oil export embargo. And what people said was, you know, we've got all this land set aside under our farm programs. Why don't we just use it to grow ethanol and burn the ethanol in our cars? And it sounded like a pretty good idea at the time because we had a lot of excess capacity then. We don't have that excess capacity anymore, neither the U.S. nor the world. We're pushing the limits everywhere. And so it's a very different situation. But I think some early environmental groups early on sort of thought it would also reduce carbon emissions and therefore would be a good thing for groups to support. Unfortunately, the latest findings, and particularly when you incorporate the effect of deforestation in the Amazon to produce, let me back up and say, when corn production or ethanol distilleries expands in the United States, it means we produce less soybeans because corn and soybeans grow in the same land. But it also means that the pressure on soybean supplies in Brazil intensifies because Brazil is the other big soybean producer now. And so they have to clear more land to produce more soybeans. And the net effect of this is when you burn off forests and clear them, there are enormous carbon emissions, not just from the above-ground vegetation, but all the organic matter in the soils from the heavy vegetation. So it turns out that all the recent studies now that have been more complete studies conclude that that we have a net increase in carbon emissions when we use corn to grow ethanol for automotive
and also,
fuel.
Lester Brown, we have to put a lot of fertilizer on the ground to grow the corn, and that's all energy intensive too, isn't it? Oil is used to produce fertilizer, so the net decrease in CO2 just doesn't occur. In fact, if you look at the equation, actually, ethanol produces in the long run through the whole cycle more CO2 than does oil. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, and much to the surprise of many. But that's there have been a number of scientific studies that have reached agreement on that point now.
Yes. I'm interviewing Lester Brown, who's the president and founder of the Earth Policy Institute. Fascinating interview, I think. Now, I'm going to talk about Australia a little. We are paying Papua New Guinea and Indonesia large amounts of money so that they don't cut down their forests because, as you've pointed out, forests are essential to reversing the greenhouse warming effect, the global warming effect, by trees capturing CO2 and turning it into wood. But in Australia, you know, we had some terrible bushfires this year in Victoria and nearly 200 people died, actually. It was a firestorm, a holocaust, like a nuclear explosion in Victoria. And
I remember that, yeah.
Oh, and it was terrifying. And the temperatures sometimes in Australia are getting really high, like, you know, 48 degrees centigrade, which I guess would be 120 or higher Fahrenheit.
Oh.
It's really scary. You know, you even wonder if you can survive in this sort of heat. But what is the reaction in Australia? And we're sort of a nation of rednecks. You use that title in America, don't you? Rednecks, conservatives.
We do, yeah.
What the reaction is, first of all, we're chopping lots of our forests down. And when we first came and invaded Australia and took it from the Aborigines, 14% of the land was forested. Now it's 7%. And we continue chopping the trees down, wood chipping them and sending them off to Japan to make fine paper, like Vogue-type paper. And the CO2 production from that exported wood is not counted in our equation for producing CO2 per capita. But more than that, because of the fires, the forestry department, they're called the forestry department, but what they do is decimate the forests, have been burning off. And around where we live, in a little fishing village on the coast of New South Wales, the air in the last 2 or 3 weeks has been thick with smoke. And as I look at this, I think, how many millions of tons of CO2 are we releasing by burning off the forests so that bushfires don't come in and burn off the forest? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's amazing how fast things are changing now. And I think it's going to be a real challenge to try to get things back under control. I think we're getting dangerously close to a point of no return on climate change, where if we don't move quickly to cut carbon emissions dramatically, and I'm not talking about by 2050, but cutting them maybe 80% by 2020, I think we could be in trouble.
Really? So, Lester Brown, you have some pragmatic suggestions about how to reduce CO2 production by 80% by the year 2020. And I would ask you too, during this question, whether you have any contact with the Obama administration and Dr. Chu, the Secretary for Energy, in this area.
Yeah, the person I know best is John Holdren, who is the president's science advisor, and before that, I was feeding material to his policy advisor in the Senate, who was also working in the campaign, and they're making some really encouraging steps, and they've appointed, to begin with, some really first-rate people like Stephen Chu, like Jane Lubachenko, like John Holdren. I mean, this is the varsity. They're outstanding scientists, and they are very much committed to taking the steps to stabilize climate. And the decision to raise automotive fuel efficiency to 39 miles per gallon in this country for new cars sold in 2016 represents a huge jump from, I think it's something like, I think last year the average vehicle sold was like 22 miles per gallon. That was the average fleet. But the newer cars have been somewhat more fuel efficient. But still, we've had this huge jump and planning to do it by 2016. So that's moving very much in the right direction. Another interesting thing happening in the States now that's more a result of the economic downturn, but not only that, is that since October of last year, the rate of scrappage of old cars has exceeded new car sales. And the latest number I've seen, based on recent monthly numbers, is that this year we will be scrapping something like 14 million cars and selling probably less than 11 million new ones. So we're actually now seeing a shrinkage in the U.S. automobile fleet, one that looks as though it's going to continue for at least a few years. And that is, of course, reducing gasoline consumption. In this country last year, carbon emissions dropped 2.8%. Gasoline use has dropped even more than that. So we're seeing a lot of changes beginning to occur now, some of it because of the economic downturn, but some of it because of new policies that the Obama administration is putting in place. And another interesting development, and this precedes the Obama administration, is the power of the grassroots movement opposing new coal-fired power plants in the United States. I mean, the bottom line of this is that we are very close to a de facto moratorium on new coal plants in the U.S. And I don't think even most Americans know this. But it's pretty exciting.
That's true. But we, as James Hansen, who's the godfather of global warming at NASA, says that we really have to stop burning coal, period. And then, of course, what worries me, and I know John Holdren too, Lester, apparently he's quite keen on Generation 4 reactors, nuclear reactors, and there's this huge push by the nuclear industry to say, well, we're the answer, you stop burning coal, but we don't produce any CO2, which is a lie in itself because of the whole fuel chain of nuclear power, which uses a lot of fossil fuel. But do you think John Holdren and people in the administration are leaning towards Generation 4 reactors or nuclear power as an answer? Or do you think because of Stephen Chu, and I know he comes from Los Alamos, the nuclear weapons lab, but do you think they're really, really going to concentrate on stopping coal burning electricity and getting into renewables in a very rapid way?
A couple of things. One, all the decisions that the Obama administration has made thus far related to building coal plants have opposed the, they've withdrawn permits, they have issued various rulings. They've not done anything at all. I mean, they're funding research on carbon sequestration, but that's so far away. It is not going to affect anything in the short term, at best for a decade, and I doubt that it's ever going to be competitive. And with nuclear, I know John's position on this coming into the administration, but there's not been any discussion of supporting nuclear power by this administration. And one of the reasons I think is that the economics are just not there. This reminds me of two sets of numbers that I find particularly interesting. One is that last year in this country, we brought online 1,400 megawatts of new coal-fired capacity. We also brought on last year 8,100 megawatts of wind generating capacity.
Wow, that's amazing.
Now, the other interesting one is to look at the global situation with nuclear versus wind. Last year, nuclear power generation worldwide actually declined. What we do not know for sure yet is how much it declined. Wind, by contrast, grew by 27,000 megawatts worldwide. And nuclear is going to almost certainly decline again next year. So
that's equivalent to 27 nuclear power stations.
It's huge. I don't think most people yet, I mean, who are not tracking these things on a daily basis, know how fast things are changing on the energy front.
Mm. Do you think then John Holdren and Dr. Chu would share your urgent need for the US in particular, but the world, to get to below 80% by 2020? And if so, do you think they're really setting in place mechanisms to do that?
One, I think they both feel that 80% is huge. I mean, Stephen Chu has made some fairly strong statements about the need to do things. He said if we don't get our act together, there won't be any agriculture in the state of California, you know, 20 years or 30 years from now.
Yes.
So he's very much aware. The idea of cutting carbon emissions 80%, the only prominent person that I can think of offhand in the political world who's supports this would be Al Gore, because he's calling for the phasing out of all fossil fuels by 2020. So he's actually a little more ambitious than we are. But he senses also the urgency and the importance of doing this. And if we don't do something like this, then we're going to be faced with so many climate-related issues. And I haven't talked at all about the melting of the glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau.
Yeah, why don't you talk about that briefly?
The glaciers in both the Himalayas, and on the Tibetan Plateau are melting very fast now, and it is the ice melt from these glaciers that sustains the major river systems in Asia during the dry season. This includes the Indus and the Ganges in India, and the Yellow River and the Yangtze in China. And not only does the ice melt from the glaciers sustain these rivers during the dry season, they sustain the irrigation systems based on these rivers.
Mm.
And if that flow is disrupted, as will happen if the glaciers keep melting and eventually disappear, then we're looking at a dramatic effect on world food security.
Mm.
Most people don't know it, but China is the world's leading wheat producer. It's number one. India's number two. The U.S. is number three, and China and India are also together. They totally dominate the world rice harvest. So when you look at wheat and you look at rice, humanity's two food staples, what happens to those glaciers and those river flows and the production of wheat and rice in India and China will affect every one of us. I mean, I think for Americans, it's tempting to say, well, those glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau, you know, we know they're melting, but that's China's problem.
Mm,
well,
mm.
It is China's problem, but it's also our problem, because if China comes into the world market for large quantities of grain, as it has recently done for soybeans, now totally dominating world soybean trade, it will come to the United States. So what we're looking at from a U.S. point of view is the prospect of 1.3 billion Chinese with rapidly rising incomes competing with us for our grain harvest, driving up our food prices. And historically, when faced with something like this, we would simply have restricted exports, as we did in the 1970s. But China's now our banker, because each month, the Treasury Department here in Washington auctions off of federal securities, and in order to cover our fiscal deficit. And many months, the biggest buyer of these securities is China. So China has, in a sense, become our banker.
Mm.
And so, like it or not, we're going to be sharing our grain harvest with the Chinese, almost regardless of what it does to our food prices.
Well, on that happy note... We've run out of time, but we could go on for another hour, Lester. It's so profound and so urgent, and I don't think that these issues have really gotten under the skin of most people to understand the profound urgency and within our lifetimes, the notion that millions and millions or hundreds of millions or billions, in fact, could be starving. And then, of course, you have to add to that the nuclear weapons destabilization situation in Pakistan and India and other countries on the verge of developing nuclear weapons. And we've got a real recipe for disaster unless we have some really brilliant visionary who can see all this happening and has the power to be able to do something about it. And I do think that that person may be Obama. That's what gives me hope. Would you, on a final note, agree with that, Lester Brown?
I would. It appears to me as though Obama recognizes that this is an important, we're living at an important point in history, and it's one that requires action and leadership. Mm-hmm. And that leadership has to come from the United States. If it doesn't come from the United States, or if we oppose it, as we have been doing for the last 8 years, then I don't think the world will make it. But I think Obama has a sense of history and understands his potential role in it, and his early actions support that.
Well, thank you for this absolutely fascinating, insightful, and visionary interview, Lester Brown, and for coming on the program.
Ellen, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Lester.
Good luck.
I've just been interviewing Lester Brown, described as one of the world's most influential thinkers by The Washington Post. He's founder and president of Earth Policy Institute, a non-profit environmental research organization based in Washington. His latest book, Plan B30, Mobilizing to Save Civilization, is published by W.W. Norton, and I very much suggest that you download that from his Earth Policy Institute site and read it or else buy it. I think it could be the Bible in a way for saving civilization. Don't forget, if you'd like to support us, you can go to the webpage ifyoulovethisplanet.org, and there is a place where you can make donations, which would be very gratefully accepted. I thank my producer in Australia, Jasmine Williams, my producer in America, Scott Powell, and my outreach coordinator, Amanda Bellaby. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week on If You Love This Planet.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.